Good morning. It's Monday, July 16th, 2018. This is Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert on today's show.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas. We're covering the Trump-Putin summit. We're going to be looking at two key topics animating the negotiations between Trump and Putin, the river of oil that runs between them and their respective governments, and the war in Syria, particularly as a potential bargaining chip in these negotiations, which just wrapped up this moment in Helsinki.
All that and a whole lot more coming up next after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. President Donald Trump says he and Russian President Vladimir Putin had a good start to their summit in Finland. Trump's brief comments came as the two leaders and their top advisors sat across the table from one another during a working luncheon. It followed more than 2 hours of one-on-one discussions involving just the U.S. and Russian leaders with only translators present. Trump spoke before he headed into that meeting.
I think we have great opportunities together as two countries that, frankly, we have not been getting along very well for the last number of years. I've been here not too long, but it's getting close to 2 years. But I think we will end up having an extraordinary relationship, I hope so. I've been saying, and I'm sure you've heard over the years, and as I campaign, that getting along with Russia is a good thing, not a bad thing.
Putin said the two had plenty to talk about.
Our contacts continue. Over recent months, we have spoken on the phone and have seen each other at various international events. But of course, it's time to discuss thoroughly our bilateral relations and various hotspots in the world. There's quite a few of them, so we need to focus on them.
Trump and Putin are soon to hold a joint news conference in Helsinki. Activists are holding 2 days of high-profile protests in the Finnish capital. Abortion rights activists dressed up in bulging bellies and Trump masks. Finland's largest newspaper put up a large billboard reading, "Mr. President, welcome to the land of the free press." Protests in Chicago for the last two nights after police officers killed a 37-year-old black man, Harith Augustus. Augustus was the father of a 5-year-old daughter and a barber. Police charged the crowds on Saturday night, beating and kicking protesters on the ground. Police quickly released a 30-second video clip that showed Augustus running away from them. As he ran, he spun around and reached toward his waist where he had a gun holstered. Augustus had a license for the gun, although not to carry it in a concealed manner. It's not clear why officers initially approached him. The video, which lacks sound, shows four officers approaching Augustus on Saturday outside a store on the city's south side. An officer points to Augustus's waist and he backs away. Three officers try to grab his arms and he tries to get away, backing into a police cruiser as his shirt flies up, showing the gun. The video footage pauses and zooms in on the weapon, which a police spokesman said was done to ensure that a semi-automatic handgun in its holster and two bullet magazines tucked into Augustus's waist could be seen clearly. Augustus then runs away and into the street as he reaches toward his waist. Augustus did not fire his weapon, and the footage does not show him pulling the gun out of its holster. It was at least the third time in the last 2 weeks that a Chicago police officer shot someone. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited a southern Israeli town bordering Gaza today that was targeted by rocket fire over the weekend. He told community leaders there that Israel is engaged in a lengthy battle. Netanyahu's visit comes a day after an informal ceasefire took hold to end 24 hours of a lopsided battle with Palestinian fighters in Gaza. Israel pounded Hamas in its most massive bombardment since the 2014 war. Two Palestinian teenagers were killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza City while they were playing in a park. 12 more Palestinians were wounded. 4 Israelis were injured when a rocket landed on their home. Egypt helped broker the ceasefire. The UN envoy for the Middle East, Nikolai Mladenov, visited Gaza and warned an all-out war was narrowly averted.
The frustration that people here in Gaza feel is completely understandable. It is boiling over. It has been boiling over for months before the protests started. I think people felt that they had lost hope in any other alternative on the ground. But I worry very much that it is not just a humanitarian crisis. It is also a political crisis and a security crisis. And that is why any approach to moving forward needs to address these three factors, not just one of them.
The California Democratic Party's executive board turned its back on Senator Dianne Feinstein this weekend and handed its official endorsement to her challenger on the November ballot, Democratic State Senator Kevin DeLeon. A total of 217 delegates voted for DeLeon, 22 cast ballots for Feinstein, 94 voted for no endorsement. Feinstein had urged the party to stay neutral in the race. The California Public Utilities Commission has approved more than $700 million for utility companies to invest in electric vehicle charging infrastructure. The transportation sector in California accounts for 41% of the state's greenhouse gas emissions. Eric Tegetoff reports.
Businesses, cities, and the state of California are using their collective power to push automakers toward an electric future. The Climate Group, an international organization dedicated to fighting global climate change, launched the Zero Emission Vehicle Challenge in cities around the world, including Los Angeles, London, New York, and Paris. Lauren Faber O'Connor, Chief Sustainability Officer for Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti, says her city is well on its way to electrifying its vehicle fleet. She says cities will be better poised to influence the auto industry if they join forces.
If you have cities acting together, you can make a real impact on the market and tell automakers that if they provide these vehicles, we will buy them.
Faber O'Connor notes that Los Angeles already has met its goal of electrifying at least half the city's vehicles. The city also plans to have an all-electric bus fleet by 2030. The state of California has joined the challenge, along with major businesses around the world. Mary Nichols, who chairs the California Air Resources Board, says a comprehensive effort is underway to move the market toward electric vehicles. She says the state's Public Utilities Commission recently approved more than $700 million in public charging infrastructure for electric vehicles in pursuit of California's ambitious plans for the future.
We believe that by 2050, every new car sold in California needs to be electric. And to get to that point, we obviously have to scale up rapidly from where we are now.
Faber O'Connor says Los Angeles has the largest electric vehicle charging network in the country, with more than 1,500 chargers spread throughout the city. She says curbing the effects of climate change underpin all of this.
We're a car culture, but we have always been ahead of the curve when it comes to adopting new transportation technologies and new transportation strategies. This is no different because of our responsibility to lead on climate change.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegetoff.
Weather forecast for the Bay Area. Patchy morning fog and clouds, then sunny and breezy. Highs in the 70s to lower 80s. In Fresno, the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny, hazy, areas of smoke, 97 to 103 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news at 94.1 at 7:30.
It is just past 7:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
I'm Antonia Juhas.
And as we speak, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin are about 19 minutes late to begin a live press conference at the tail end of their summit in Helsinki, Finland, that they called coming out of that meeting. We expect to be bringing you updates and reaction from whatever it is they announce or say on camera. We may not be able to get you any tape from it until 7:30 news headlines, but we thought we would spend the bulk of the time in the opening 20 minutes of our program to recap the whirlwind of developments going into that summit that may have impacted it. And joining us in studio, our esteemed colleague, Mitch Jeserich. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, everybody. Yeah.
So the big curveball coming out of Washington going into this summit was the announcement by Rod Rosenstein on Friday morning that he was unveiling indictments against 12 Russians who are members of Russia's military intelligence unit, the GRU, for launching hacking attacks in the United States during the election, targeting John Podesta, the chair of the Clinton campaign, 33 computers associated with the Democratic National Committee, the systems of various secretaries of state, from at least one of which they allegedly lifted data on 500,000 voters, and the systems of election software providers. Specifically, the allegations regard a company in the business of providing voter verification services. This is something our listeners may have heard covered many times on KPFA. It's principally software used for taking away voter registration from people who already had it. it threw a curveball politically into the negotiations because it prompted almost immediate calls from Democrats for Donald Trump to call them off, which, of course, he did not do. When he was ticking off a list of concerns he intended to discuss with Vladimir Putin at today's talks, he explicitly did not mention the allegations in the indictment. I think the other thing that's notable here, we'll get into this in reaction in a minute, is that although there have been indictments against Russians before, regarding the 2016 election, they were not direct employees of the Russian military hierarchy. The previous indictments were people working for a so-called troll farm called the Internet Research Agency, owned and operated by an oligarch who is very close to Vladimir Putin, but at least with enough room for plausible deniability between the actual government and the people subject to indictment. That is not the case with the 12 people who have been named as working for the GRU and launching hacker attacks on U.S. computers. So, big deal? What we were expecting? Mysterious timing? Questions about the facts? What do we think?
Well, I'm sorry that we'll probably never get a trial out of all of this, right? Because it's very unlikely Russia would extradite these 12 members of the United States to actually have a trial. In fact, I think it's against the law in Russia to extradite people to be tried in another court. And so that's the first thing I would say, because I think it's a big deal, but I also think a lot of it we kind of already expected. It's basically now the Mueller team, the Department of Justice, kind of affirming what a lot of people have already expected. And the reason I wish there was a trial, because to me, now I have always felt that, I've felt that the allegation of Russia hacking into the DNC computer service was probably true, mostly because that's kind of what countries do to one another and meddle. And to me, I feel like this is just more confirmation in the sense of I guess we call it a sniff test over a conspiracy theory, is the more people that are involved in it, the less likely it's actually a conspiracy that's just concocted, right? Mm-hmm. Because you just have so many people that have to keep things under the lid. So now we're talking about the Justice Department and the Justice Department office. Now we're talking about the FBI and all the people in the FBI that are working on this. We're talking about two congressional committees. Even the House Intelligence Committee doesn't refute the evidence about Russia hacking into the DNC computers. But yet, nonetheless, there are people, and I think it's important to be critical and skeptical of information that comes from government, that still hold on to the view that this is all concocted. So in that sense, I wish we did have a trial, because then you can present all the evidence that's going to go out there about it. And in presenting that evidence, then you can have people defend themselves and you hash it out, you know, and I think it makes it much more... it just brings much more attention to the issue, but it also, I think, would help give closure, which I don't actually think this does.
But also, we're talking about two different issues, right? So, or two separate issues, not necessarily different. One is the hacking of DNC computers during the election by the Russian military. A separate question not addressed in this indictment is potential collusion with the Trump campaign. So I think that these indictments, as you say, are something that we've been leading up to. But now we have this exceptionally thorough indictment, which is really written for the general public, I think, to understand the charges, and written in such a way that we can read it, understand it, and see that what seems to be quite likely that this hacking took place, and then that it was used very skillfully to try to move the election in the direction of Donald Trump. Given that it is an indictment about election hacking, but doesn't talk about whether or not there was participation by the Trump campaign, it is also startling that the president of the United States didn't say that this is something that we want to look into and that I want to talk about when I meet with the president of Russia on Monday. Mm. The timing was obviously geared towards before these two men meet. And one of the ways you could see this is the FBI giving the president of the United States the best information before he meets with the president of the country that's being accused with manipulating, intentionally manipulating our elections.
Yeah, and on that note, we should point out at his press conference on Friday, Rod Rosenstein, the acting deputy attorney general who's in charge of the investigation, did say that he had fully briefed Trump on these allegations before Trump left for Europe. So this was not like a Friday morning ambush on the president. President Trump knew this was coming down the pipeline when he made all the framing remarks going into the summit before he even left U.S. soil. I think that's an important coda to throw on, because otherwise it looks like a very political move,
right,
to release it on basically the eve of the summit.
And yeah. Even given that he had this information, the President Trump had this information earlier, he still refers to the evidence as a witch hunt in his tweets.
Yeah.
He doesn't refer to it as evidence about the potential hacking of the elections by the president of Russia. He refers to it as a witch hunt, meaning that he, of course, is immediately taking the evidence of Russians hacking the election as a witch hunt against him and potential collusion with the Russians.
I keep struggling with this stuff, kind of like what is the useful information in terms of like what you can possibly act on? Like, what leaves you some room for agency? And I find a lot of the Russia investigation to basically be a spectator sport, which is why we have not covered it with great frequency or great detail here. To me, on the, like, what's worth attention, what's worth action front, the most important thing here was the hacking attacks on state-level Board of Election systems and election software providers. The potential for any malicious hacking entity to influence an election through our increasingly digitized voting systems has been a preoccupation of the left in this country going back to the 2000 elections, mm-hmm, and the role of Diebold voting systems. Mm-hmm. And it's been publicly known and publicly discussed that there were Russian attempts on U.S. voting systems in the 2016 election for over a year now. The federal government appropriated money to help states hardened the security around their voting systems. And as far as we know, up to the present, that money hasn't even been spent. And I think that the basic mechanics of looking at the hackability of voter rolls, of voter data, and of actual voting machines and vote tabulation systems is something that is worth a whole lot of attention going into the midterm elections. And that's a not just a criminal discussion, that is a policy level discussion, that is a like basic mechanics of government and democracy discussion that needs to happen if people are going to have any confidence in the outcomes of what happens at the ballot box.
Yeah, critically important. Also because we have, if in fact, it seems clear since the Russians, the indictments are about the Russians hacking the DNC computer and the DNC's emails and putting that information out with an attempt to sway the election on behalf of their chosen candidate, Donald Trump. We also have midterm elections. We also have another presidential election coming up in which Donald Trump will be on the ballot. And we need to know what are the weaknesses within our voting system so that we trust them against any potential hack, domestic or foreign, and by any actor. And then if we have the active attempt of a foreign government to continue to sway our elections on behalf of the sitting president and his party and the candidates of his choosing.
Yeah, I think you both make important points there, especially when we talk about hacking into and attempting to hack into. Now, they haven't said they changed any votes, but still getting into a state election system is a pretty big deal and something you want to take very seriously. On the other issue of hacking into the email of the DNC, my take on that, well, it's a legitimate question that I have, is how high of an offense is it? Actually, is it high enough, as Democrats are calling on Trump to cancel his meeting with Putin? I have some doubts about that. And the way I see it is this way. Again, countries meddle with each other's affairs. We know the United States does it as well. If it was some other entity that would have hacked into the DNC's emails, because let's remember the information that came out of the DNC hack. It wasn't false information. It was true it was true emails that painted a picture that the Democratic National Committee was favoring Hillary Clinton in the primary. and that Clinton's campaign were calling the shots on some pretty important issues for the DNC. All that information was very true. And if this hack would have happened, and let's say it didn't lead to a Trump election, many people who are now upset about it may have probably would have supported it because it would have shown some wrongdoing that's going on there. And so I'm not saying it's okay to illegally hack into somebody's email system, but I think it's worth asking how high of an offense is it?
So first of all, it is a crime. That's why it's being investigated by the DOJ. Second of all, I think if the American left has no problem fiercely criticizing our own government for interfering in the elections of other countries, then we should be equally critical of any other country that interferes in elections here. That's just a question of consistency. You know, I see absolutely no point to saying every country does it, so let's throw up our hands in the air and not worry about it. But I think the third thing is, and you see this in the narrative of the indictment, this was not some nonpartisan effort to advance transparency in the American election. First of all, Republican files were hacked and never released. So there was a selective release of information. It's very clear in published correspondence between the GRU front account, Guccifer 2.0, and Organization One, which is almost certainly WikiLeaks, that the discussion was about how to time and frame the release of this information for the maximum impact on the American election. And I think those are all areas of great concern. And frankly, although I'm a great fan of transparency, we do have minimal constitutional guarantees of privacy through the Fourth Amendment. And there is an acknowledgement at every level of jurisprudence that people should be able to keep some basics of their thoughts and dealings with one another private. So I don't know. I think it's a big deal for all of those reasons. I think you are right. If that information had come out earlier, say in the primary, and advantaged Bernie Sanders, there would be a lot more people cheering for it than you hear now. But I think on a how should we think of it, phenomenally troubling, selective, timed for impact, malicious intent.
And I also think, you know, obviously then this then merges into a discussion of looking at intent. So what was the intent of that leak? Or, I'm sorry, of that hack. Excuse me, it wasn't a leak, it was a hack. What was the intent of the hack? And then the outcome. And so for me, what I've been most concerned about from the beginning, looking at the question of the role of the Russian government within the election, potential collusion with the Trump administration, is the outcome of having, and it now comes to fore in the summit taking place right now, who are these two men that are now the heads of Russia and the United States who are working together, and what are they working towards? So for me, the outcome is, what does it mean in terms of policy, not the U.S. and Russia, Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump? What are these two men have as their goals as political leaders, and where do those goals unite and overlap? And for me, as someone who's spent a very long time being concerned about the role in oil in guiding politics and power and discussions and influence, you've got Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, who are two men who are both leading governments that are intent on the world remaining an oil world, because it's how they see their governments as maintaining and driving power. And they are deeply united in that agenda, and it's guiding critical policy. Obviously, climate policy, but also wars, ongoing wars, potential wars. And the fact that the Russians manipulated the election with the intent of hopefully seeing an outcome of Donald Trump as president, and then how that is then playing out for if Donald Trump, whether or not there was intentional collusion or not, at least a sense of I owe you, and if I want to see this, if I want to continue to be president, a potential debt owed to the Russian government, what that then means in terms of policy moving forward. It's what is this, what is the relationship between these two leaders, and what does it mean for policy you know, guiding these nations moving forward.
Yeah, I think oil is a big issue, one that's not being talked about very much. And this would have been an issue regardless of what happened in the election or you know, hacking into the emails or all this other stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, but the Trump regime is entirely different than what the Obama administration was and what the Clinton administration would have been.
On oil.
Yeah, and on the role of oil. So, I mean, there's lots... I could obviously talk about this particular topic for hours. Unfortunately, we're going to talk about it for the next half hour in our next segment. But most importantly, the Trump administration has switched U.S. policy from one of energy independence, meaning the idea being that we produce enough here to use it here, to one of stated global energy dominance. The United States will be a power like Saudi Arabia, like Russia. And Putin has very clearly made very clear that he intends to see the Russian government driven in its continued role of power through oil. The Trump administration is much more akin to the Bush administration in its use of oil, the ideas around oil. But even I would argue going further than the Bush administration, because it doesn't have the sort of, I don't know, desire for maintaining an institutionalization. It's really just a, you know, let's get everything that we can get before we're thrown out the door. Whereas the Bush administration wanted to continue to see Republican presidents, you know, for a very long time. And that's a terrifying thought. Mm. Clinton and Obama, certainly friends of the industry, but nothing like the Bushes or the Trumps, the Trump administration.
I think also worth thinking for a minute about what's happening in domestic politics right now. The day before the latest round of Mueller indictments were rolled out, there was this circus of a joint House-Senate hearing on Capitol Hill where the FBI agent Peter Strzok was called up to testify about his texts that suggested he might not be the biggest fan of Donald Trump, texts issued while he was working on the Clinton email investigation. Mitch, this is something, seems like ages ago, but you wanted to make sure we brought up in Monday's show. For Republicans in the House, at least, in the Freedom Caucus, it was the warm-up act to rolling out articles of impeachment against Rod Rosenstein that are expected sometime this week.
Yeah, potentially as early as today. I don't know how much support amongst the entire Republican caucus in the House of Representatives that is going to have for the impeachment of Rod Rosenstein. I suspect it won't have much. Trey Gowdy over the weekend on one of the Sunday morning talk shows said that he would not support the articles of impeachment. So we'll see how far that goes. I doubt it actually gets that far. They may bring it. It wouldn't surprise me if the House leadership try to squash it, actually ever keep it from coming up for a vote, like they have other things, including immigration. And then could the House Freedom Caucus get enough support after that to force the issue? I doubt it. So, you know, it's something to watch, something that's interesting. I don't think it goes very far. That hearing on Thursday was really something else. In fact, it reminded me of a Pacifica National Board. it was so chaotic. And what was really interesting to me, and you see it just at the very beginning of the hearing, the first question from Trey Gowdy himself, who is the chair of the House Oversight Committee, and this was a joint committee hearing between Judiciary and Oversight. They both got together. His first question to Peter Strzok, who is the FBI agent, sending text messages with Lisa Page, really, you know, critical and damning of Trump, and he was, for a short time, the lead investigator in the Trump and in the 2016 election campaign, as well as the investigator in the Hillary Clinton email situation while she was Secretary of State. Anyways, his first question to him was, have you started, when you were text messaging Lisa Page about Trump, did you already start interviewing people concerning the investigation into the Trump campaign? And he said, well, the FBI is not allowing me to answer that question. He's still with the FBI. Now, Mueller let him go from the investigation after he saw the text messages, but he's still an employee of the FBI. So the FBI said, legal counsel said, no, you can't answer anything that's about a pending investigation. And that makes sense, right? Because if he says, yeah, I already did, well, now you've put out some information about the chronology of who talked to who and these type of things, you actually could potentially give up some details you may not want to give up in that way. And what was remarkable to me is then Bob Goodlatte, who's the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, then claims that he is in contempt of Congress and is going to potentially force a vote. And then Democrats erupt on that. And it was just shocking to me. You know, I was a congressional correspondent 12 years ago now. If you would have told me 12 years ago that FBI agent would be testifying to Congress and refuse to indulge information about an ongoing investigation, and it was the Republicans who were going to hold him in contempt, I would have never believed it.
But the way it played out that hearing, it really felt like a setup and ambush. Like, they knew what the answer was going to be to that question.
Yeah.
Like, they're sophisticated enough to know that FBI agents aren't allowed to comment on ongoing investigations, but they performed such outrage at his response.
Yeah, it was all political theater. I truly do believe that. I mean, it was really interesting to watch because it was so chaotic. But it was definitely political theater. I think it was very much about the 2018 midterm election. I think what Republicans are trying to do is whip up their base to show up in the midterm.
Yeah, but also to clearly undermine the FBI in the public's
attention. And that's part of it.
And attack the FBI as an institution that shouldn't be trusted.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's how it played off if you watched Fox News.
And even more than the midterms, that's also about any impeachment votes that might come up.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've said it before. I think it's worth recapping. The political calculus for Donald Trump is he gets to stay in office if he gets to keep a majority of the Republican base on his side.
And
not a majority
have a Supreme
of the public.
Court that won't indict the president or that won't take down the president.
If he can keep enough people in the public to cost Republican incumbents primary challenges and keep them more worried about his supporters than they are about Democratic challengers, then he wins impeachment, which is ultimately a political process.
But Trump's not the one who called that hearing, so.
Yeah, but they're in this difficult position, right? Trump's base really isn't moving in the public opinion polls. So now they kind of have to make their case for the election.
and that's why it'll be really interesting to see. I mean, if you're only playing to the base, only playing to 30%, it could be really bad for
that's
you
right.
come the election. But that's what will be interesting to see how it all plays out.
In any case, we have gone on. It is 7:33 in the morning. The program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tieker. We are now 43 minutes late for the press conference with Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump that was called to begin at 6:50 a.m. Pacific time this morning. We will be back getting reaction to, well, what we currently don't know about the outcome of that summit after these news headlines with Eileen Alfandary.